Well, hey, everybody. It's good to be with you this weekend. My name is Eric, and I am one of the pastors on staff. Happy 4th of July weekend, wherever or however you celebrated. We're so glad that you decided to spend part of your weekend with us. And today, I'm really thrilled to be here because we are starting a brand new series called Meltdown, Handling Emotions in the Heat of the Moment. And let me tell you right now, with the heat of summer fully on, there are lots of things that are melting down right now. We are especially feeling this in the Torrance household because our fridge and freezer decided now was the perfect time to kick the bucket this past week. And so what was melting down in our house was ice cream. And do you know what ice cream is without the ice? Not very good. That's what it is. It's not very good for anything. But heat can come in multiple forms. Sometimes it's when the outside temperatures rise, but also sometimes it's when life gets kind of crazy or life doesn't go our way. And I bet for a number of us who have ever had or currently have a toddler in our life, we know what this looks like, that what melts down when that heat rises is not ice cream, it's people. In fact, did we show that toddler picture? I think I had a picture up. This isn't my kids, not because my kids never melted down. It's just that I never thought, let me snap a picture in this moment and capture it for all of eternity. I never really would do that. But I've had this or a form of this happen in the parking lot at grocery stores. I've had this happen at church. You've seen me. A few of you have helped me out or have had pity on me in those moments. I've had this happen in the worst possible place. Any guess? Airplanes. Airplanes is the worst possible place for that to happen. And so I think we've all seen that. And I think we also know from experience that there are some common causes to a toddler meltdown. At least this is what I've learned as a parent. One of the culprits is screen time, or screen time being taken away. That's a big culprit there. Also, bedtime. Or especially when it gets a lot later the light stays out a lot longer, that is a slog to try to get a kid down. So bedtime is a big one for us. When a mess happens, this one kills me the most, is that when a toddler makes a mess in the house, not only are they inconsolable, but suddenly it's also my job to repair or fix the thing that they caused while consoling them at the same time. So a mess is part of it. Who gets first place? Or more honestly, who loses? Candyland can get pretty vicious really quickly in those cases. And one of my favorite ones too, toys. Toy distribution. Is there the right amount? Whose is bigger than the other ones? This one has caused a lot of meltdowns. And you probably are seeing a little bit where I'm going here. I think more than we would care to admit, the things that cause you and I to melt down are not that much different than maybe we would like to admit from a toddler. Like toys, for instance. Maybe it's not this, but it's something like this that's a little bit bigger that a neighbor somehow started driving that we don't have. That has caused a meltdown for me. Screen time as well has caused a significant number of meltdowns for me, particularly when the Wi-Fi stops working or there's no internet available. That can be a little dicey. I like to win. I also, whenever I have messed something up big in my life, or maybe caused a mess in someone else's life, that has really messed me up from time to time. But one of my most memorable meltdowns actually had to do with bedtime. And bedtime for adults is not that we have to go to bed too early, at least for most of us. I think a lot of us would say, that sounds pretty nice. This meltdown happened because something or someone messes with my sleep. That'll cause a really big meltdown. One happened to me a few years ago. In fact, this was several years ago, when Amy and I had just gotten married, and we were living in kind of a townhome-style apartment complex. And to this day, I still don't know exactly how this apartment complex was arranged in the architectural drawings, but the way that it kind of worked was that our bedroom was above the one-car garage of our neighbors. And then they had a staircase that kind of wrapped around the side of it, and then they had a bedroom that was directly above our bedroom as well, which meant that basically we could hear everything when they were coming and going, particularly when we were trying to sleep. What we would come to find out is that it was a brother and sister that lived above us. The sister was really responsible, but she worked the 5 a.m. shift at Starbucks. So we could hear every time she, you know, dutifully decided to go to work, which is a good thing. I'm happy for her, but that would wake us up. And the brother, we never found out exactly what we did. We just knew that he liked to stomp around late at night. Maybe it was Dance Dance Revolution. Who knows? But whatever it was, he liked to make a lot of noise. And one night, he decided that it was the perfect time to host an all-night rager party right above us in our bedroom. And at that point, I had been boiling up for a long time. It had been simmering for a while, and I had a massive meltdown moment. Like, I ran outside in the middle of the night in our complex parking lot, looked up at the window, and started yelling. Like, in a short amount of time, I aged by about 80 years. I became the grumpy old neighbor in our apartment complex. And honestly, it had really no effect. No one could hear me, but I had melted down. That's mine. Now, I'm betting you have yours too. In fact, I'd love it right now if you turn to your neighbor and just share about a recent meltdown moment. Okay, just kidding on that. Some of you got just nervous. I didn't even want to let that linger too long because some of you are like, this is not a church I signed up for that. No, none of us are really all that proud of it, but it would be helpful for this talk for you to think of a recent meltdown or two that you've had, maybe just something that came out of you that was kind of unexpected, and have that in your mind. And just for clarity's sake, not all meltdown moments have to be angry ones. I mean, sometimes meltdowns take the form of us getting really discouraged. Or maybe it could be super jealous of somebody or something that someone else has in our life. Or it could also be when we get incredibly fearful. In fact, the Bible, I love this, has a time where it talks about a meltdown like this. The people of Israel had just had a moment because of their own disobedience, had a moment of big defeat where they had an enemy that overtook them in a massive way. And they, because of that battle, they fled from it. And this is how it describes them in Joshua 7, verse 5. It says, at this defeat that they suffered because of their own sin. At this, the hearts of the people melted in fear and became like water. I mean, isn't that a relatable image? I think a number of us could say, man, I can think of a time in my life that I felt my heart melt in fear where it became like water. And so whatever your meltdown is, whatever form it takes, have it in your mind. And what I'd like to propose to us today as we engage God's word on this topic is that there are two responses that we tend to have in meltdown moments. Two responses that in the moment feel really natural, but are actually insufficient. And here's what I mean by that, that these responses are not completely unhealthy or wrong, or even all that bad. In fact, sometimes there is great wisdom in these responses. But what we'll see today is that if we stop at these responses, if we don't go any further, we actually miss out on a profound and powerful opportunity. An opportunity that can really only be found in meltdown moments. And so for us to see these two insufficient responses and the better, more profound choice that you and I have in these moments, we're going to look at two teaching moments from Jesus' ministry. The first one comes from Matthew 15. And in this part of Jesus' ministry, he had just done a number of amazing things. He had healed some people of some sicknesses. He had walked on water. And he had, again, formed quite a crowd around him. People were engaging with him and they were curious, but he also created a lot of criticism and skepticism from those that were in religious leadership. And this is what happens in Matthew 15. It says, "Then some of the Pharisees and teachers of the law came to Jesus from Jerusalem." And that is always a hint in the text that whenever it says from Jerusalem, it's actually that they're coming down to criticize or question or try to poke him a bit. And this is what they try to do. And they asked, "Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? They don't wash their hands before they eat." To which all of us go, "Ew." Like, that's kind of strange. I mean, if there was one thing that we learned in COVID, it's that a lot of us were not washing our hands as much as we should have been washing. Didn't we pick up on that? At least I learned that, okay, I probably wasn't washing them the way that I guess I was supposed to or the depth that I was supposed to do. So that's something that we all carry with us. But in this moment, this isn't actually talking about personal hygiene. And we know that because from the text, it says that they asked about the tradition of the elders. What is that? Well, the tradition of the elders was basically a set of teachings that were add-ons to the Mosaic law, to what Moses had commanded the Israelites to do. These add-ons were basically secondary rules or secondary regulations that would help someone, keep someone from accidentally breaking one of the commandments or one of the things in the Mosaic Law. So think of it like a secondary rule that sometimes we have adopted. And again, there's some reasons for this, but a secondary rule could be like, hey, I'm not gonna say the word darn because it's too close to another D word. That, again, there's some wisdom in that, so I'm not saying that that's wrong or anything like that. But what was happening in this moment is that these religious leaders, and over time, these secondary rules had actually grown in importance to where they had become as important as the big laws themselves. And so in the tradition of the elders, when it came to personal hygiene or cleanliness, they had a lot of cleanliness, purity laws in this tradition. These laws were basically put in place so that it would keep someone from accidentally becoming unclean or not right before God. Almost like if they had touched something that was considered unclean, that they didn't want to put that in their mouth. And so they had extensive rules and regulations that would keep them from doing that. Rules like when they would wash their hands, they would put their fingers up for a certain amount of time so that all the water would drip off. Basically, all the spiritual cooties would get off of their hands. And then they would also put their wrist down for a bit to let it also drip off too. Again, to completely get rid of all the bad stuff because this was super important to them. And that's what's happening here and what they're questioning Jesus and why he's doing that. But Jesus, when it came to these additional rules and regulations, he wasn't buying it. In fact, he and his disciples would regularly, they honored the Mosaic Law, they honored the commandments, but when it came to these additional regulations, these man-made ones, it's almost as if Jesus went out of his way to break them. And he gives us a reason for it in Matthew 15, verse 17, and it continues like this. It says, "Don't you see that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and then out of the body?" Which we say, well, thanks for the biology lesson, Jesus. I appreciate that. We see that a couple times a day. But he continues. "But the things that come out of a person's mouth come from the heart, and these defile them. For out of the heart comes evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false testimony, and slander. These are what defile a person. But eating with unwashed hands does not defile them." What Jesus is saying that is that rules upon rules don't actually get to the root of the issue. They don't go deep enough to what matters to God. That what God is after, and you see this throughout all of Scripture, you see this in Jesus' ministry, even with the Sermon on the Mount, that he consistently changes the focus from external behavior into internal action, internal heart condition. And the reason is that God is after a relationship. He's not after ritual robots that do everything always right and good conduct all the time. And that God is also after what is best for you and I. And that what is best for you and I is that we are whole from the inside out. And so you'll see consistently that Jesus's emphasis is not on good conduct. I mean, and again, that's all good. He wants to see the outward part of that, but he always brings the focus back to the internal behavior. But you and I, on the other hand, tend to focus on the external behavior. It's what the religious leaders back in the day did, and it's what you and I will do as well. And that's what leads me to our first insufficient response when it comes to our meltdown moments. The insufficient response is that we, in that moment, adjust our behavior. It's that after a meltdown happens, I think we're all kind of wired to say, well, that was embarrassing. Like, I don't want that to happen again. And so in that moment, we kind of reach for the most obvious conclusion, you know, the most obvious solution that we can implement into our life. Like, for example, in my meltdown moment in the apartment complex, I was like, the next day, I was like, well, that, I don't want to do that again. And so what did I do? Well, I decided to buy a white noise machine and put it in the room, which was kind of a good thing to do. I also made a behavioral change, which was to say, okay, well, I kind of just need to be more tired when I go to bed at night. So I'm going to work out a lot more, like a lot more, to make sure that when bedtime comes, I am ready to go to sleep. Again, nothing bad with that. I think tweaks to our behavior can look like, okay, you know what? I'm going to avoid that trigger or that situation again, there's some wisdom in that. I'm not going to try to say that anymore or go there anymore or be at that place past 10 p.m. at night, or I'm going to make sure I'm up at a certain time in the morning. All of these have some wisdom in them. But I think what Jesus would tell us is two things to those things. He would say, okay, one, we probably know from experience that those kind of commitments can be short-lived. And two, I think Jesus would tell us that some of those commitments can be short-sighted, that they don't go quite deep enough to what the real issue is. Jesus would talk about this again at a different part in his ministry in Luke chapter 6. And he uses actually an illustration of a tree, and this is what he says. He says, no good tree bears bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. Each tree is recognized by its own fruit. People do not pick figs from thorn bushes or grapes from briars. A good man brings good things out of the good stored in his heart, and an evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. For out of the overflow of his heart, the mouth speaks. What Jesus is talking about here, he uses a tree to illustrate this, is he's talking about the concept of congruence. Congruence is basically that whatever an internal condition is, the external condition will match that. So basically that an apple tree will produce apple fruit. That's just kind of common sense. It also say, you know what? An unhealthy tree will produce unhealthy fruit. That's the concept of congruence. But as you and I read this today, I think it begs a question of saying, okay, well, what happens in our life when we come across a moment of incongruence? When you and I maybe have something that comes out of us that we would say, you know what? That's not who I am. Like, that's not actually like, whoa, where did that come from? That's not me. And I think in those moments, you and I have a tendency to kind of dismiss it as an aberration. Almost like it's a kind of one rotten apple in an otherwise great bunch of fruit that we just sort of dismiss. I mean, I think we kind of get used to, at least I do, where we kind of say, okay, our best fruit, we sort of polish it up. You're like, you know, we put it on social media or we put it out in front of people. It's like, hey, man, this is going really great. And if there's a bad piece of fruit that's sort of rotten, it's like, I would just kind of quickly throw it in the bucket. It's like, you know what? I don't know where that came from. That's not that big of a deal. Or I think, at least for me too, that when I have that rotten fruit that kind of pops up in my life, I kind of tend to sort of blame it on the conditions. It's almost like, well, the reason why it's rotten is because, you know, there was too much sun or, you know, the conditions were bad. And that brings me to insufficient response number two, that in meltdown moments, what you and I are tempted to do is to shift the blame. To say that the reason why I reacted the way that I did was because of the circumstances, because of a situation that I found myself in, or because of a certain person that found themselves right next to me. And this is a good time not to look at your neighbor, just so you know, trying to help you out here as best as I can, leave happy with whatever it is. But sometimes we think that way, right? That the reason why I reacted the way that I did in the moment that I did was because of a person or a thing that made me do it. Or sometimes we even go to the place where it's like, you know what? The devil made me do it. Sometimes that's what pops up too. And you know what? The reality of it is that sometimes that's true. Like at least in my apartment situation, again, like my first reaction was, you know what? The reason why I reacted the way that I did was because I had a rude neighbor. And you know what? I had a rude neighbor. But the problem with that kind of perspective, and the reason why this response can be insufficient, is that then the first thought that came into my head was, you know what? The way that I will fix my meltdown situation in this moment is to move, is to get away from the rude neighbor. And the challenge with that, though, and I think we know this from experience, is that while moving could be part of the solution, we tend to carry some of those same issues with us, and they will bubble back up in different ways. Like in my life, like I noticed that we did eventually move, thank goodness, that did help quite a bit. But several years after we moved, like we moved into a house because we were trying to start a family. And so we eventually did have my oldest son, Ben, which was an amazing life-changing experience, but it was also really, really disorienting for me too. My schedule completely changed. I was never a morning person. Now suddenly you have to be a morning person and a late at night person as well. But on top of that, he was not the easiest baby. He was not great at feeding. He had a lot of acid reflux early on. He just didn't like taking a lot of food. And we tried everything. You know, we switched him onto a bottle pretty early on. And so a lot of times I would do the late night feeding. And I remember one night in particular, I'm doing the late night feeding and I am struggling to get him to take 1 ounce. And I got him to get the ounce in. And then just a few seconds later, it all came right back up again. And I remember in that moment, something inside me just bubbling up, that there was an anger and a rage that I just hadn't really, I couldn't really put my finger on it, but I hadn't quite experienced it that way before. Almost like it scared me, because it's like I wanted to scream at this baby that I loved so much, but also to say that it wasn't his fault. I mean, he was 2 months old at that point, that there wasn't anything he was consciously doing, that it made me realize in the moment, okay, wow, there is something bubbling up inside of me that's more than just what's happening in this situation. I don't know if you can relate to that. I don't know if you've ever experienced something like that. It's a moment where it puts into context the words that Jesus said in that passage we just read, where it says, out of the overflow of our heart, the mouth speaks. And I think what Jesus would say to me in that moment, and possibly to you if you've experienced something like that, is that when something like that bubbles up, we need to listen to it. It's actually trying to tell us something that's important for us to hear. Proverbs 4 talks about overflow of the heart as well. In fact, it kind of outlines a better, more profound choice that you and I have in the moment. And this is what it says. It says, above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. I've heard this verse several times, but as you dive into it, the word guard can be a little tricky, because at first glance, we can kind of think that it's really about just protecting stuff, almost like, man, I want to keep bad stuff out from getting inside me, which there's an element of that. But when you actually look at what the original language says, the wording of here is much richer than that. That guarding is actually more of keeping careful watch or close examination on something, almost like a guard would do to a prisoner that they're watching in a prison. Or put in a more positive light, that somebody that is watching over a valuable treasure would keep careful vigilance, careful watch over it. That's the way that we're supposed to watch over what's happening inside us. And it gives us a reason for that. It says that it's because your heart is the overflow, is the power source of everything that's going on in your life. I think you and I understand this when it comes to our physical hearts, you know, and the importance of keeping a watch over that. I got a personal view of this not too long ago. Two of my three kids, when they were young, were in the pediatrician's office, and the pediatrician heard something in their heart when they were doing one of their annual examinations. They would say, hey, we heard a noise, we're not really sure what it is, and so they recommended that we go to a pediatric cardiologist. And so we took both of them separately to go in there and do it. And I remember the emotion that it took when I was taking both of these young babies basically into the cardiologist's office, and they hooked up all these machines and they did an ultrasound on each of their hearts, and you could see the blood flowing through all the different chambers, and we would come to find out that for both of them, no medical intervention was needed. One of them, it was just what they call a noisy heart. I guess that's a thing, where it was kind of like, oh, you just have a loud plumber heart. Like sometimes they do that. And for another one, it was that she had a small hole in her heart that would heal over time. And so nothing was needed. But I remember throughout the whole experience being terrified, because we know the importance of the heart. That it's like, okay, this is my child's like very life. Like this is how the blood is pumped through their bodies. It's like, I wanna make sure I'm doing everything I can, that we're doing everything we can to make sure that it's as healthy and as whole as we possibly can. But what about our non-physical hearts? What about our emotional hearts? And when I talk about our hearts in that way, it's more of that idea that your command center of your emotions, your command center of your thoughts, the command center of your very soul, the core of who you are. That's trickier to find out how that's doing. because you can't just take an ultrasound of that part of you. In fact, I think most of us work the opposite of that, where we do a lot to cover up how that part of us is doing. There's a lot of pressure for image management, where we want to say, okay, I want to present the very best of myself out there, whether it's on social media or not. Or we've learned to kind of conceal and cover up some of the behaviors in our life to kind of make sure that we're looking okay. We do that so that we can get the first date or the second date. We do that so we can get the job. We do that so we can survive our family reunions. We do that so that we can make it work, and I understand why we do that. But the reason why meltdown moments are so powerful, the reason why there is such a profound opportunity whenever we have something like that happen in our life, or something bubbles up, is it's a chance that something inside of us made it past all of the different filters in our life. It's almost like it's an EKG for your non-physical heart. And in that moment, you and I have a choice to make. It's a choice that's presented in Proverbs 4:23. It's a chance to say, okay, when something bubbles up within me, will I do one of the two insufficient things? Will I kind of just dismiss it and say, okay, I'm just going to adjust my behavior and kind of move on? Am I just going to shift the blame and say, you know what, that's probably a situation issue or something else? Or will we say, you know what, this is worth diving into. There's something going on beneath the surface that I need to pay attention to. When I think of this choice, it reminds me back to a time when I was in college and when Hurricane Katrina happened. Some of us remember Hurricane Katrina. It was actually back in 2005 that Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. That is almost 19 years ago, which is crazy. I wasn't in New Orleans at the time. I wasn't even in Texas at the time, but I know some of you were. In fact, I've met a number of Chase Oakers who, the reason why you're here is that you were you had to relocate from New Orleans because of all the damage that happened. For me, I was in college, and I remember seeing the images of the devastation that happened because of that hurricane on the city. And I just remember my heart being moved by it. I was like, okay, I want to do something. I want to do anything to be a part of it. And so we were part of a campus ministry that organized with a bunch of other colleges throughout the nation to come and do some relief work in New Orleans. And so I jumped at the chance to go. So I remember when we arrived, several months after Hurricane Katrina, all the floodwaters had dissipated. And I remember seeing the damage and just being awestruck at how much of it there was. That in most of the places, we would go into different homes, that the water line was at 8, maybe 9 feet high. And everything below that water line had been devastated by water. Family heirlooms and furniture had just been destroyed. In fact, I have a picture of one of the houses that we went to go in. This was before any work was done that was inside. You can see just the devastation that had happened in people's homes. Like, these were their whole livelihoods that had been impacted by it. And so our job, as we went to go do the relief work, was to go in where homeowners had invited us in and said, okay, if you'd like to come in to basically help remove the damage, which meant taking out lots of personal property that meant a lot to these homeowners, but it also meant having the ultimate goal of getting rid of all the dangerous stuff that could impact the health of the family. Most especially the mold. That was the biggest issue that each of these homes faced. And the mold had gotten everywhere. I mean, I'm talking everywhere. It wasn't just in furniture and all that. It was oftentimes in the walls and behind the walls. And so the only way that you could fix that was to actually take a home down to the studs. In fact, I think we have a picture of my wife and I. We weren't married at this time. This is another story for another time. I was crushing big time in this picture. She had firmly put me in the friend zone. So if you're in that situation, there's some hope, I guess. It can happen. It did for me. It just took a long, long time to get there. But again, that's a story for another time. But this is the home that we had, one of the homes that we had to take down to the studs. And that's what it would look like. Because the only way that you could really get it back to where then the family could start to rebuild was to take it to that level. And so I remember going to different homes, and there was one home in the middle of the week that we were out there where the homeowner basically said to us, hey, thank you for coming, thank you for helping, but the only thing I want you to do is to scrape off the mold from the drywall on the outside. That basically the process of going any further was just too painful for her. And I totally get why. But I remember, and we did exactly what she asked us to do, but I remember the whole time being really, really discouraged. Because we knew that that whole time while we were doing that, again, just happy to serve her however we could, but we knew that behind that, that the problem itself was not being fixed. And that, if anything, the problem wasn't only not being fixed, but that the real issue, the mold that was behind the walls, would continue to grow and grow and grow and continue to make that family sick and sick and sick. And that there was nothing we could do about it in that moment because, again, for the homeowner, it was too painful. I remember the next day we went to a different house. And this situation was pretty similar. Again, the lady that we had helped before, she was an older single lady. She didn't have a lot of help. This lady that we went into the next day was an older single lady, didn't have a lot of help. Her house had the same amount of damage in it. And I remember her attitude was that we came in and she immediately greeted us with hugs. And we said, okay, what would you like us to do? And she said, please, please take it to the studs. And not only that, she started to hug each other. She's like, you've got to take it to the studs. That's what we need you to do. And the whole time we are literally ripping apart her house. She's bringing us food. She's singing songs. She's praying over us because she knew that this was the part, this was exactly what was needed for her to get to where she needed to go. And that's always stuck with me, her perspective. I mean, it works in so many ways, but when you and I think of the issues that we face in our life, that lady's perspective just resonates with me, that sometimes to address what's really going on, you gotta take it to the studs. You gotta be willing to say, you know what, instead of settling for a surface level solution, that in that moment, instead of saying, hey, when something bubbles up inside of me that maybe wasn't pleasant or something that I'm not really proud of, that instead of just saying, okay, I'm gonna make a tweak of behavior here and fix it, you know, and it'll be fine. Or you know what, hey, that's just a circumstantial thing. You know what, that's not really who I am. That in those moments, if we actually make a decision to say, okay, I'm gonna take a moment to do what Proverbs 4:23 says and say, okay, my heart is trying to tell me something and I'm gonna dig in and listen. You know, bring this full circle for me. That when I, after I had that moment where I had that moment that bubbled up and I was getting angry at my 2-month-old baby who had nothing to do with that, that it wasn't long after that that a friend of mine introduced me to a resource that I found to be helpful. Some of you have found it to be helpful too. It's called the Enneagram. Again, I know some of us are into it and some of us are like, I don't even know, that sounds kind of strange, and I totally get that. But I remember they gave me a book that's called The Road Back to You, which is actually was way more helpful to me than trying to take the online assessment or whatever. I found that to be not super duper helpful. But I remember when I read the book, it started to describe these 9 different personalities that are a part of the basically the theory. And the personality, the number that stood out for me was that I was a 9 on the Enneagram, which the label for the 9 is the peacemaker, which that sounds just so nice, doesn't it? It's like, oh, I'm a peacemaker. And I think people have validated that. They're like, Eric, you're so nice. And I was like, oh, thank you. That's great. But I remember being surprised when I dug into this tool, because the way that the tool works is that there, you know, there's 9 personalities, but they kind of divide it into 3s, and they call them triads. And so the 9 is in a triad that's kind of defined by each triad has its own dominant emotion. And the one that the 9 is dominated by is anger. And I was surprised by that. I was like, well, what are you talking about? I'm not angry. And then it clicked. It was like, oh, wait, maybe I am. The way that the tool described it was that 9s have a tendency to numb or push down anger because they want to not have to deal with it. And that in that pushing it down, what happens when you push things down at different times, it'll bubble up, particularly for a 9 when you get backed into a corner. And that's what was part of my experience. I remember that realization has helped in so many ways, whether I've had more conversations that have been not about surface level stuff, but actually saying, okay, this is an issue in my life. This is something that I need to talk about with those closest to me. I need to talk about with a counselor. I need to talk about with God, because that's where he can meet me with him on that. But it all started with a key decision to say, you know what? I'm not gonna look outward. I'm actually gonna look in to see what's happening within me. You know, throughout this series, I'm excited because each week of this series, we're going to be looking at an emotion that tends to live deep down inside of us, that actually threatens to control our life if we're not careful. And each of the speakers this series it's a home run. I mean, you're in for a huge treat. Like, we're going to have Ryan Leake. He's going to be talking about anger. We've got a great new communicator, Ashlyn Stanley. She's on staff. She's going to be talking about fear that tends to be there. We've got our campus pastors. They're talking about guilt. Next week, we're bringing back by popular demand April Farmer, who will be talking about envy, which is amazing because not only is she an amazing Bible teacher, she's actually a therapist as well. So I think it'll be so helpful if that's something that you or a friend has ever struggled with, of jealousy, or man, I just don't want to be driven by consuming things. But for this series to work, it all starts with a basic decision. It's a decision to say, you know what, in those moments where I could look outward, I'm actually going to drill in deep. And so as I close today, I have a question for all of us to wrestle with, and that is, how's your heart? Not just your physical heart, I do care about that. Go get your annual physical and all that stuff. But how's your core? And if you were to connect maybe some different moments that have happened in the last couple of weeks, or maybe the last couple of months, is there a common thread that connects them where you would say, oh, like there's more of that in there than I was expecting? There's a pastor in Atlanta that says that what comes out of us is an indicator of what's going on within us. And so as you think about what's come out of me lately, is there an indicator of maybe what's going on in you? And as you and I wrestle with that question together, it's actually a profound opportunity for us to bring it to God. Because God is not after robots. He's not after, you know, just good conduct. He wants a relationship with you. He wants a relationship with me. And a relationship, the best ones, are where we connect at the heart level, where we're actually vulnerable about what's going on in our lives. And in those moments, it's actually the most profound connection opportunities that we have with God. I like how in Psalm 34, it says this. This is about maybe being discouraged, but I think we could connect this with so many emotions. It says that the Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. And so whether you're feeling incredibly discouraged, maybe incredibly fearful, maybe you're like me and there's more anger within you than you would care to admit, or maybe it's just guilt, this is a chance for us to open up our hearts and God will meet us in that moment. And with that in mind, will you pray with me? Father, we thank you that you are close to us when we are most open to you. That when we put down the facades, when we stop trying to manage our image, when we maybe decide, I'm not gonna settle for surface level solutions, but instead, I'm just gonna be open about what's going on in my heart, that's where you meet us in a profound way. And so whoever is listening and whatever they may be feeling in this moment, Father, I pray that you would meet them in a powerful way today as we bring our emotions to you. And with that, we pray in the name of your Son, Jesus, amen.